Sailors have to put up with a lot of bad things, but there's one thing that sailors simply cannot stand, and that is to be becalmed with no wind, no breeze on the water. In these circumstances, sailors can fiddle about the boat for a short period, perhaps resort to telling some sea stories, but they expect the breeze to return soon. And when it doesn't, they get fidgety. They start getting at each other, and bad things can happen aboard the boat when there's no breeze. And that's what we're about in today's story, How to Raise a Breeze. Hey, shipmates, welcome back to the Sea Stories and Science Fiction Podcast. I'm your host, Malcolm Torres, and I've got a great story for you today, another tale from Ocean Adventures, published in the 1850s by John Shelbourne Sleeper. Today's story is How to Raise a Breeze. Before we jump into it, I just want to make a couple of quick announcements. We're over 30 episodes now here at the Sea Stories and Science Fiction Podcast. We have a few more stories to go, and we'll wrap up Season 1. We'll take a short break for a few weeks, and then we'll start putting out the stories in Season 2, which is going to focus more on science fiction, horror, crime, maybe some weird tales, ghost stories. There should be some sea story tie-ins, though. So if you're enjoying the show, I need you to help. I need you to join me on social media, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, YouTube. I'm on all those platforms. It's Malcolm Torres at Sea Stories and Science Fiction. Give me some likes. Give me some shares. Make some comments. Give me some shout outs to your friends. Little word of mouth. I'm really trying to build a community around Sea Stories and Science Fiction, and it's working. I've got a lot of followers. I'm getting a lot of comments. But we really need this thing to blow up. So thank you all for joining me, and I look forward to seeing you out there on the social media networks. One other thing I'll request is please get on over to Apple iBooks or Amazon and check out my free and for sale stories. I've got paperbacks, short stories, free stories on there, all sea stories and science fiction type stories about some of my times in the Navy, some things that I've just fabricated out of strange experiences that I've had, all good, salty stories involving adventure, crime, romance, disasters. Really appreciate it. Thank you so much. So now we'll just have a quick word from our sponsor, and we'll get on with today's story. Today's story is How to Raise a Breeze. There is nothing more destructive to the patience of a sailor, a real old-fashioned, web-footed old salt, than a calm sea. Other evils he can bear, if not with resignation, at least without losing command over his feelings and his temper. Miserable grub, he can put up with, though perhaps not without a grumble. A short allowance of water in a hot climate is not agreeable, but with a grin of disgust, he submits to his lot. Hard work, and plenty of it, is hardly regarded as an evil, but welcomed as a blessing. A leaky ship, a dull sailor, and skulking shipmates are matters of course, and excite no particular manifestation of indignation or regret. And a furious tempest, especially when on a lee shore, brings out all his energies and makes him as happy as a dandy at a dancing party, or a porpoise bound on a long cruise. A calm is a different thing. Like many other terrible ills of life, it comes not only without being desired, but without being expected. And all Jack's philosophy melts away before it, like a spongy cake of field ice when it strikes the Gulf Stream. The flapping of the sails against the mast is discordant music in his ears, and the thrashing of the ropes about the decks conjures up scowls and mutterings, not loud but deep, which clearly indicates that such lifelike motion is not poetry in his eyes. His short, jolly countenance becomes elongated till it reminds one of the equator, all longitude and no latitude. His eyes, which are wont to kindle with mirth, or beam with good nature, flash with anger and ferocity. From a frank, open-hearted sailor, ready at all points to meet the frowns or favors of fortune, and willing to doff the world aside and bid it pass, Jack seems transformed, as if by the trick of some wicked enchanter, into a morose, surly savage, an Ishmael, whose hand is ready, with the slightest provocation, to be raised against every man, a cannibal, whose glowering looks manifest a fearful propensity to make a meal of his shipmates if an opportunity should occur. Such is the magical effect produced on the character and conduct of a whole ship's company, from the captain to the powder monkey, by a calm sea, and the change becomes more marked in proportion as the storm is protracted. I verily believe the calms have given rise to more bickerings, strife, heartburnings, and bitter quarrels among the officers and crews of vessels, and have caused more brutal treatment on the one hand, and scenes of insubordination and revolt on the other, than, with the exception of rum, all other causes combined. And now, having attempted, successfully, I hope, to give those of my readers who have never dipped their hands into a tar bucket or been ducked by a deluge of salt water, some ideas of the evils which are attendant on a calm, evils which, although dreaded by the experienced sailor more than a typhoon or a waterspout, are unsuspected by the landsman, I will fill away the main topsail and shoot ahead, or, in other words, proceed with my narrative. The ship Mephremagog was bound on a voyage to San Salvador in the Brazils. She was a good, stout, old-fashioned, dull-sailing Boston ship of some 350 or 400 tons, with a bright side and bluff bows, square stern, and a fiddlehead. She was commanded by Nicholas Brandt, Esquire, and could boast of two mates, cook and steward, and nine men before the mast. Captain Brandt was a shipmaster of the old school. He was a tall, lathy-looking piece of humanity, with but little flesh on his huge bones, but possessing extraordinary muscular developments. He was a good, practical sailor, having spent many years of his life at sea, a man of decision and energy, cool in the hours of peril, devoted to the interests of his employers, and faithful in the discharge of his duties. He prided himself on his skill in managing his ship and in making short passages, which he mainly attributed, and probably correctly, not so much to good luck as to his own vigilance and personal attention, being a great portion of the time on deck himself, seldom taking a regular nap, expecting when lying to in a gale, and seeing with his own eyes that the officers and crew did their duty, especially in doubtful weather and in the nighttime. In this way, advantage was taken at once of every change of the wind. The yards were braced up or squared without unnecessary delay, and sail made or taken in precisely at the right time. It is astonishing how much may be gained by personal inspection of this kind on the part of an active and efficient shipmaster. How many hours and days saved in a passage? Captain Brandt was somewhat annoying and troublesome to his crew, in consequence of his unremitting exertions to get along as quickly as possible. They would have been much better pleased if he had accustomed himself to take a stiff glass of brandy and water at 8 o'clock in the evening and turn in, as was the custom with some of the shipmasters in those degenerate days, and there remain snoring in his stateroom until 8 bells on the following morning. But in other respects, Captain Brandt was kind and indulgent, especially during a fair wind, and was loved and respected by the men. Notwithstanding, he always maintained strict discipline on board, and was prompt to check at all hazards the slightest symptoms of insubordination. The Mephremagog had been out about 28 days, having had a fine passage up with the Cape Verdes, for Captain Morey's strait cut out across the Atlantic to the equinoctial line was unknown in those days. Captain Brandt had sanguine expectations of making a comparatively short passage to Brazil, and, if possible, redoubled his care and executions to shove his old tub-bottomed craft along through the water. But when about 60 miles to the southward and westward of St. Anthony, the westernmost of the Cape de Verde Islands, the wind, which for several days had been blowing fresh from the eastward, became much to the mortification of Captain Brandt light and baffling, and manifested symptoms of dying away altogether. The night which followed, although the moon shone bright upon the water, and the atmosphere was clear and tranquil, was a long and unpleasant one to the skipper, who paced the deck impatiently hour after hour, while the sails flapped as the ship rolled lazily to windward, and no sign of a phosphorescent wake could be witnessed on gazing over the stern. "Here comes a breeze at last," he would exclaim as the shadow of a cloud passed over the surface of the water. "Blow, St. Anthony, blow! Don't desert us at the last pinch." And when the main topsail would strike against the mast as if it would fly out of the bolt ropes, and with the rattlings of the ropes and the creaking of the mast and the yards make music which sounded right dismally in his ears, at such times he would smite his hands furiously together and declare with a frightful emphasis that he would sooner 1,000 times listen to the fierce howlings of a hurricane than the discordant, monotonous, squeaking sounds caused by the flapping and slatting of the sails and running rigging. His impatient exclamations, his grumblings and mutterings, however, produced no effect. Towards morning, the ship lost steerage way altogether, and by 8 o'clock it was a dead calm. Hardly a cat's paw was seen on the water. And throughout that day, and the following one also, the Mephremagogue lay like a log floating on the surface. This was an event of an annoying character, certainly, but one at which Captain Brant had no reason to be surprised. For vessels bound to the southward of the line, by steering so far to the eastward as to reach the vicinity of the Cape de Verds, are very apt to get becalmed, and these calms sometimes continue for several days. But the captain of the Mephremagogue had coaxed himself into the belief that he would be especially favored, although it might have puzzled him to give a reason why, and that a fine breeze would propel him cheerily along across all the doldrum latitudes. He was doomed to disappointment, and I regret to record it, he did not bear his disappointment like a philosopher. Captain Brant had no more rest during the day than through the night. He gave one a good idea of perpetual motion. He not only kept wide awake himself, but he kept all hands alive throughout the ship. He was upon the lookout for a breeze in every direction, watching the clouds, whistling at times, at other times singing or shouting or giving vent to his feelings by language neither classical nor refined, but which, candor compels me to say, unless he has been grossly slandered, verged closely on the profane. "Hello, Mr. Thompson," would the skipper exclaim, rubbing his hands. "There comes a breeze at last. I see the cat's paw creeping along over the water. How does she head, Tom?"
"East-southeast, sir."
"Very well. Call the hands aft, Mr. Thompson, and brace round the head yards. Let us box her off, and then see all clear to board the main tack. Keep her south-southwest, Tom, when she falls off enough."
"Aye, aye, sir," replied the helmsman, giving a sly wink to his shipmates, who was coiling up the spanker sheet.
But alas, the cat's paw never reached the ship. The old Mephremagogue persisted in looking directly to the eastward. The sea looked as glassy, the sun's rays as coppery, and scorched as fiercely as ever, and the sails flapped with redoubled violence against the mast. Captain Brant, in his vexation, would stamp the deck as if he would split the planks, kick the steward, find fault with the mates, and launch anathemas against all hands, then stop suddenly, take up a chip, throw it over the side, and gaze upon it earnestly for a few moments, until he saw that it was disposed to linger on the spot where it was thrown, and to stick closer to the ship than a brother, when he would give utterance to some untranslatable exclamation and turn away with a look of disappointment and unmitigated disgust. After taking a few turns fore and aft, he would whistle an impromptu, deprecatory tune, more spirit-stirring than any of Uncle Toby's lillabaloos, but without conjuring up a breeze. Then he would apostrophize the winds, commence in a mild and persuasive strain, but ending in a style peremptory, fierce, and emphatic. "Blow, good breezes, blow! Do blow, if only enough to fill the sails and get steerage way on the ship. Blow, I say, why don't you blow?
Blow, I tell you, blow, until you blow the sails from the yards or the masts over the side. Blow, I tell you, blow. But the winds were alike deaf to his urgent entreaties and his fierce and menacing commands. The surface of the deep continued undisturbed even by a ripple. Nor was this impatient feeling confined to the skipper. The crew felt deep in their hearts the magic influence of the sultry calm, became sour and sulky, glowered fiercely at each other, gave short answers to the officers, and grumbled furiously in voices inaudible to the captain and mates, however, when ordered to the performance of any duty. The malign influence of the protracted calm extended even further. The steward, a fine-looking mulatto, looked as grim as a savage, but this might have been partly owing to the uncivil treatment which he received from the captain, and the steward in his turn was very short, sulky, and unceremonious, to a degree verging on insolence, to the cook, a big, brawny blackfellow who moodily attended to his duties about the galley, and every now and then breathing forth guttural denunciations in broken English against the weather. Such was the uncomfortable state of things on the afternoon of the second day of the calm, when Jack Thompson, a mischievous but jovial sailor, fond of a practical or any other joke, passing along the main deck where a couple of his shipmates were serving a rope, suddenly snatched away the light straw tarpaulin hat which covered the coconut of Jeremiah Nichols, a youth but recently from the hills of Berkshire in the good old state of Massachusetts, and gave it a sea toss far away from the ship's side into the water, exclaiming at the same time, "Hurrah! This for old Neptune in exchange for a breeze!" Jerry's astonishment at such an unlooked-for proceeding knew no bounds. He could not at once appreciate the justice of the act or conceive why his individual property should thus be sacrificed as a propitiatory offering to the hoary god of ocean. On recovering from his astonishment, his first impulse was to knock down his joking shipmate, but fortunately recollecting that the indulgence of his revengeful feelings would not recover his chapeau and might be attended with danger to himself, he abandoned this pugnacious intention and, springing headfirst overboard, struck out vigorously in the direction of the old tarpaulin. The cook, who was leaning over the railing, indulging in some abstract philosophical reflections, as was his wont, turned pale with affright on seeing Jerry tumbling head over heels into the water, and instinctively screamed with all his might and main, "A man overboard!" This terrible cry reached the ears of the captain, who was down in the cabin, trying to raise a breeze by pommeling the steward, and he hastened on deck and rushed forward to the waist. By this time the officers and men had there assembled, and were intently gazing on Jerry as he manfully buffeted the billows. Suddenly, by a few rods off, a large shark was seen, with his dorsal fin and the upper portion of his tail several inches above the surface, stealthily swimming along in the direction of Jerry, whom the rascal seemed to eye with a deep-seated affection, not altogether of a fraternal character. "A shark! A shark alongside!" was the cry which now resounded fore and aft. "Look out, Jerry!" shouted the captain. "There is a shark after you! Come back, you good-for-nothing vagabond! Lower away the boat there! Where is the harpoon? Hand along the grains!" All was now confusion on the decks of the Memphremagogue. Some hastened to lower the boat, and some sought for the harpoon, the grains, and the boat-hook, with a view to do battle to the voracious monster, and create at least a diversion, under cover of which their shipmate might escape the fate which seemed impending over him. But the boat was thoroughly lashed, and could not be lowered in a hurry. The death-dealing instrument could not be found immediately, and the shark, with his evil eye glistening with the anticipation of a luxurious feast, was meanwhile creeping along rather closely towards Jerry, who, frightened almost to death, was making superhuman efforts to get on board. He had reached the side of the ship and clutched the bight of the main top bowline, which was thrown towards him, when the ferocious monster, fearing he was about to lose his prey, suddenly turned over on his side, preparatory to making a grab at the thigh of a well-fed Yankee sailor. Those of the crew who were looking over the side simultaneously uttered a fearful shriek, for the boat was at that moment only rounding the quarter of the ship, and the captain had not yet got ready the harpoon. They gave up their unhappy shipmate for lost, when Jack Thompson, who had been foremost among the most active in rendering assistance, leaped upon the gunwale and with a stunning voice called out, "Watch there, watch!" jumped up with all force directly on the back of the shark. The feat was a desperate one, but it was admirably executed. The feet of the chivalrous sailor struck the man-eating villain fairly, just abaft the shoulders, slipped aside, although in different directions, and for a moment only, Jack Thompson was seen riding a cheval on the back of the sea monster, with his knotty features lighted up with a smile, as if he thought it was the funniest thing in the world. The shark thus unkindly interrupted at the moment he was making up his mouth for a delicious bite, manifested more astonishment than indignation. He turned aside abruptly from the tempting morsel before him, and made a dash downward through the water that unseated Jack without ceremony, and left him floundering about like a hooked albatross. In the lapse of a few minutes, Jack and Jerry were both safe and sound on the deck of the Memphremagog. The questions now arose among the excited crew. What had become of the shark? Can we not capture the audacious scoundrel? He was soon espied from the starboard quarter, prowling about as unconcerned as a pirate who has just made a whole ship's company walk the plank, and looking as innocent and demure as a mermaid, quietly combing her long sea-green hair and singing ballads upon the rocks. The calm for the time was forgotten, and every man on board the ship was bent on the capture of the ferocious fish. The boat was hoisted up at the stern, and preparations were at once made for catching the common enemy of sailors. The skipper called for a piece of pork from the harness cask, and the mates were soon busied in making running bowlines and getting in order the harpoon. And for a shark hook, properly so called, there was none on board. The captain cut off a junk of pork of the size of his fist and threw it far off in the direction of the shark. The fish soon detected the white and attractive object and leisurely moved towards it, eyed it with much interest, smelled of it, and then bolted it with much apparent gusto and looked around like poor Oliver Twist for more. Another piece lured him still nearer the ship's quarter, and it was clear that he had recovered from the alarm which Jack's gymnastics feat had excited in his bosom. A running bowline of stout rope was now lowered into the water, through which a piece of ratlin stuff with a big piece of pork at the end was passed and thrown some fathoms from the ship's stern. The shark saw the tempting tidbit, and his eyes shone and his mouth watered at the sight. He made hastily towards it, and it was drawn nearer the ship as he advanced, until he had passed his head and shoulders through the noose, when the upper part of the bowline was dropped, and by a dexterous pull of the rope, the unsuspecting villain was firmly caught in a trap, from which, in spite of his tremendous exertions and convulsions, leaps, he could not extricate himself. He was then, by the united strength of the ship's company, hauled alongside in triumph, and after some labor and notwithstanding an obstinate resistance on his part, was hoisted on board, when three cheers were given for his capture. But it was soon found that there was little cause for exultation. The shark was uncommonly restless on the deck of the Memphremagog, as uneasy as a fish out of water. He could not be made to lie still, and with his strong jaws and sharp teeth, snapped at everything in his way. Ropes from 3/4 to an inch in diameter that lay scattered about the deck were seized upon in his rage and severed as clean as if cut with a knife. The cry was now, "Kill the rascal!" This was more easily said than done, but a furious assault was made upon the captured fish by the whole ship's company, armed with hatchets, axes, handspikes, and boat hooks, and dire was the noise and dreadful was the confusion that reigned on board. Long and gallantly the shark fought and struggled for life, and more than once he came within an inch of grabbing one of his enemies by the heels. But it was not in the power of any fish to contend successfully against such odds, when out of his native element, and after a fierce and unheard-of contest of about 20 minutes, the shark, brained with the cook's axe, after dodging it 2 or 3 times to the great detriment of the deck planks, was obliged to succumb. His tail was then decapitated, as Nick Mulroney called it, and nailed to the belfry as a trophy, and the carcass was thrown overboard amid loud rejoicings from the whole crew. While these important events were transpiring, but little attention was given to the weather, the calm for the time was forgotten. The excitement, however, soon passed away, and a reaction followed. The captain again became brutal, the mates gruff and the men sulky. A breeze was demanded more clamorously than before, but alas, the clouds hung motionless and heavy about the horizon, and there was not the slightest indication of a change. The night passed away, and the sun rose on the morning of the Sabbath, and the ship remained rolling and tumbling about on the ocean, with not a breath of wind to fill the sails. After breakfast, Jack Thompson, who had been thoughtfully looking over the bow, as if speculating on the immense depth of the ocean, suddenly turned round and, addressing Jim Blaney, a rough, web-footed, veteran man-of-war's man, said, "I'll tell you what it is, old fellow, this will never do. If this calm lasts a day longer, we shall all become savages and something worse, four-legged barbarians. For what I know, can't we contrive some way to raise a breeze?" "You tried it yesterday," muttered Jim in a voice which sounded like a cross between a shriek and a steam whistle, "and I shouldn't think you would care about trying it again," and he contemptuously turned away, chewing the cud of sweet and bitter fancy with redoubled industry. "Never mind, old Tantara Bogus," soliloquized Jack. "If I don't raise a purchase to kick up a breeze or some other shindy before night, it won't be for want of trying, that's all." The hours passed heavily away, as if borne on leaden pinions. But about 1 bell p.m., while the men were still employed in bolting their salt junk and boiled duff, they were abruptly roused from their labors by the voice of Captain Brandt, who imagined he saw preliminary symptoms of a breeze, and indeed some dark, suspicious-looking clouds seemed gathered in the horizon. He kept the crew at work for half an hour at least, bracing round the yards and trimming the sails, but it all proved in vain, a mere flash in the pan. After this well-timed and wholesome exercise, without conjuring up the ghost of a wind, they were dismissed, and all hands relapsed into the usual inactivity which prevails on shipboard during the Sabbath day in pleasant weather. The captain retired to the cabin, fatigued and disgusted, and throwing himself upon a couple of sack-bottom chairs, tried to murder time by taking a nap, in which he succeeded and was soon snoring away as if for a wager. The chief mate shut himself up in his stateroom, where he sweltered in a closed atmosphere of a temperature something less than 120 degrees. The second mate, who had the watch on deck, amused himself, seated on the hen coop, by trying to solve a problem in navigation. Of the crew, one half were turned in and reeling off sleep at a rate of 10 knots an hour. The other half, with the exception of a man at the wheel, were scattered about the forecastle, some grumbling in an undertone to themselves about the weather and hard usage, one sewing a patch on the elbow of his pea jacket, and another reading the Bible on the heel of the bowsprit. But all, excepting Jack Thompson, looked as sour, sad as a sea elephant after he is knocked on the head. Sam, the cook, having put matters and things to rights in his galley, stretched himself at full length on the hot deck and was taking a pleasant snooze, with his head well cushioned with wool, resting on a handspike, and the steward, having collected his various utensils, tools, and condiments, which he had been using in preparing the cabin dinner, had gone aft and was busily stowing them away in his pantry, little dreaming of the ill treatment which was in store for him. At the moment, Jack Thompson, who, with a countenance beaming with mischief, had been for some time carefully watching the various proceedings on deck, stealthily stepped to the caboose and abstracted from the fire a live coal of goodly size, which he quietly deposited in a natural nest among the wool which grew in such luxuriances on Sam's head, and then resumed his place on the forecastle, lighted a cigar, and with a sedated countenance began reading a well-thumbed edition of Dampier's Voyages. In a few minutes a thick and fetid smoke began to issue from the head of poor Sam. The unctuous nature of the wool rendered it quite combustible, and the smoke, settling down about his face, tickled his olfactory organs, and made him sneeze and twist up his features into a ludicrous expression of alarm. "Gorramity!" exclaimed Sam, raising his head. "What the devil to pay now? What thing is this fire?" In the meantime, the singed wool was fizzing and sputtering away at a great rate, and the unfortunate man, rising upon his pins to ascertain the cause of the strange phenomena, felt an uncertain and burning sensation in the side of his head, which soon resolved itself into a sharp and agonizing pain, and instinctively putting up his hands, he convulsively clinched the crumbling cinders of the burning coal, which caused him to utter a prolonged howl, which reverberated from the bulwarks and the poop deck, and was heard throughout the ship. At this unlucky moment, the steward was coming forward toward the galley, and seeing the unfortunate conditions of poor Sam, and the grotesque contortions of his countenance, he could not refrain from indulging in a hearty laugh. This roused the ire of the doctor, who owed him a grudge for former insults, and believing that he had discovered the mischievous author of the joke, he rushed upon the astonished steward, exclaiming, "So, this is the way you play your pranks upon a gentleman, is it? I'll teach you one thing and make you know better next time. Smother me in my slush barrel if I don't anyhow." So saying, with the impetus of a battering ram, he thrust his smoking head against the brawny bosom of the steward, who, uttering a sonorous grunt, staggered backward several paces and fell heavily upon the deck. This assault upon the steward and its decisive result was witnessed by Jim Blaney, whose attention as well as that of all hands was now directed to these operations on the part of the belligerent parties. And Jim, who owed the steward a debt of gratitude for occasional favors in the shape of cabin delicacies, was irresistibly prompted to take the part of that functionary. He sprang towards the indignant but victorious cook, crying, "What are you about there, you rascal?" and gave him a lounder on the side of his head, which few men could have withstood, but which only caused Sam to show his ivories in a grin of defiance and shake his head half a dozen times, as if to restore its equilibrium. He was not backward in returning the compliment, and hit Jim a severe blow over the left eye, which caused that organ to be surrounded immediately by a magic ring or dark halo, which increased rather than diminished the picturesque grimness of his countenance. The steward had now recovered his senses and came quickly to the rescue. He attacked the doctor in the most savage scientific style, who would soon have been badly beaten and vanquished by superior numbers, had not Jack Thompson, with the chivalry characteristic of that mischievous tar, seized a deck swab and put a speedy end to the pugilistic exertions of the steward by drawing it somewhat roughly across his face and eyes. Others of the crew hastened to the scene of combat, and without inquiry, particularly into the cause or nature of the row, gladly availed themselves of the opportunity of giving free indulgence to their pugnacious propensities, which had been growing stronger and stronger since the commencement of the calm. With yells of rage and delight, they thrust themselves into the thickest of the affray, and, like pugilistic demons, let loose from pandemonium, squared away at each other, right and left, and for about 5 minutes there was as furious a combat and as pretty a scene of confusion on the decks of the Memphremagogue as one would wish to behold on a summer's day, and that day the Sabbath. The mates, hearing the disturbance, hastened to the scene of action with the laudable desire of quelling the fury of the combatants and keeping the peace. But it would have been better for them if they had kept quiet and minded their own business, for in the midst of this terrible hurly-burly, their official characters, were not recognized by the combatants, and they were regarded only as good and substantial objects for receiving sturdy blows and hard knocks. And although they dealt with them lustily in return and shouted furiously in behalf of peace and order, they soon found themselves in a sorry plight. And now the captain, hearing the tumult which awakened him from his nap, and supposing that the breeze had come at last, bounced on deck, and his astonishment and anger may be imagined when he beheld the whole ship's company, including the cook, steward, and both the officers, engaged in a terrible battle on the main deck, and covered with blood and foaming with rage, giving and receiving blows and hitting away at each other indiscriminately, howling and shouting like so many fiends. Captain Brandt gazed for a moment on the tumultuous scene. A look of savage delight lighted up his weather-beaten countenance. His organ of combativeness had been screwed up to the highest pitch, and now an object was presented on which he could direct all its pent-up energies. He grasped a heaver in his hand and threw himself into the midst of the combatants. I have already said that Captain Brandt was a tall and powerful man, and by this time some of the crew had become exhausted by the violence of their exertions, and the two men stretched along the deck, fully satisfied with the treatment they had received. The captain, therefore, with the exception of a few sly knocks which he received from unknown quarters, had it pretty much all his own way. He soon, by the aid of his heaver, tumbled three or four of them on all fours, among whom was the second mate, who was hit by mistake in the confusion, and the rest of the crew were soon scattered in different directions. The cook, whose unjust assault on the steward had caused the affray, had, some time before, while the others were together by the ears, wisely withdrawn himself from the contest and retired within his galley and closed the doors. Fatigued and heated with the exertions, the captain stood with his bosom panting, leaning against the gunwale, victor in the combat and master of the battlefield, when, as he turned his head toward the east, he felt a refreshing puff of air full in his face. He recognized it as a joyful symptom of a breeze. He looked up, and all his unexpended energies, which had so lately been called into action, were pointed in another direction. While the storm raged on the decks of the Memphremagogue, a storm of a different character had been brewing in another quarter. The clouds, which had been hovering about the horizon during the day and suddenly collected together in the dense and dark mass, had risen rapidly, and a terrific squall was about to burst upon the ship. Captain Brandt sprang upon the quarter-deck, and in a voice loud, animated, and distinct, which rang through the ship like the notes of a clarion, and awakened in the bosom of every man a sense of his duty, he shouted, "All hands muster on deck at once! Here's a heavy squall coming! Clew up the topgallant sails! Lower away the spanker! Rise the foretack there, some of you, and stand by to square away the yards! See the topsail halyards all clear, and stand by to clew the yards down on the cap. Let go the halyards fore and aft. Clew down, clew down. Hard aport your helm. Square away the yards. Mind your helm now, Jack, and steer steady, just as she goes with a wind right aft. Hurrah, we have got a wind at last." The rain fell. The wind blew, and the sea rose, but nobly the good ship dashed along over the water, like a courser just loosened from his tether. All hands participated in the exultation of the skipper, and in their rejoicings at a change of weather, forgot their late quarrels and the many hard knocks they had so lately given and received. As for Jack Thompson, as he stood laboring at the wheel, while the ship bowled along some 8 or 10 knots, to the southward, he met the exulting glance of the captain as he walked aft with an arch leer from one of his bunged-up eyes and exclaimed in a subdued but triumphant voice, "I knowed, sir, I could raise a breeze." God, these stories in Ocean Adventures, they just keep getting better. I mean, what's better than this? The crew is becalmed. They literally having a riot amongst themselves, and they catch and beat a shark to death. They're playing jokes on one another. And again, it's back to that, those superstitions about how to raise a breeze. You need to start a fight amongst the crew, of course. That's what will happen. That's how you raise a breeze. Just outstanding, salty sea stories in this book. I love them. Well, that brings us to the end of another episode, shipmates. And thank you for joining me. And I look forward to connecting with you online. And I do want to give one little shout out for, there is a story that I have online that's near and dear to my heart. It's on Amazon. It's called Making Peace with Japan. And I wrote this story. I was aboard the USS Enterprise in the mid-1980s, and we made a port call in Sasebo, Japan. We are a nuclear-powered vessel, and the Japanese people were not happy about this. They had some protests going on when we came into port. And it's just the story of three young sailors who go ashore, and they have some interesting adventures amongst the people in the town, dealing with the rioters, meeting some young girls, and going out to some bars and restaurants and shopping malls and parks. And it's a slice-of-life story about some Navy sailors going ashore in Japan, but it's also a reckoning with history. These young sailors and everything they stand for as part of the U.S. Navy, coming to terms with the memories and the after-effects of World War II from the 1940s all the way to that time when the story takes place in the 1980s. It's just a short story that's near and dear to my heart. It's for sale on Amazon for $1.49. If you'd like to make some kind of contribution to me or the show for doing all this work, putting on these stories, that's how you do it. Just go buy some of those short sea stories that I have on there, or some of the paperbacks and novels that I have on Amazon and iBooks, and read them and post a review. Many thanks, and until our next episode in a few days, as always, fair winds and following seas, shipmates.